This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mel White was once about the most sought-after ghostwriter by leaders of the religious right. He ghosted books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. White also wrote speeches for Oliver North. White kept a big secret from his clients. He's gay. It took many years for him to even admit that to himself. White was married for 25 years and has 2 children. For the past 10 years, he's been in a relationship with a man, Gary Nixon. White remains a committed Christian, although he's left the conservative Christian culture he was brought up in. He's now the dean of Dallas's Cathedral of Hope, a branch of the Metropolitan Community Church, which is an ecumenical denomination founded in 1968 to serve gays and lesbians. After ghosting memoirs for other people, White has written his own, called Stranger at the Gate, To Be Gay and Christian in America. In the back of the book, he reprints a letter he wrote to Jerry Falwell.
A letter to Jerry Falwell, December 24, 1991. Dear Jerry, in 1986 and 1987, when I was ghostwriting your autobiography, Strength for the Journey, there was no reason for us to talk about me or about my life story. Your publisher, Simon & Schuster, and your agent, Irving Lazar, had hired me to do a job, and I did it. You never asked me about my political beliefs or my personal values. And though we came from 2 rather different worlds... I liked you immediately, and I appreciated your frankness, your sense of humor, and your loyalty to friends and family. For your friendship, and for the clients you have sent me, I am grateful. But in the past few years, Jerry, it has become more and more painful for me not to share with you my own personal journey. Now, in light of your October 1991 letter against homosexuality and homosexuals, I can no longer remain silent. I am gay. For the past 8 years, which include all the time I've been in your employment, I have been in a loving, monogamous relationship with another gay man. I'm a member of a Metropolitan Community Church congregation, the only Christian denomination that is truly open to gay and lesbian people, and a member of Evangelical Concerned, a national Bible study and prayer movement of gay and lesbian evangelical Christians.
Well, you wrote that letter Christmas Eve. What inspired you to write this letter to Jerry Falwell on a Christmas Eve?
I got the letter that he sent out to his constituency, really bashing gays. And the letter was so horrendous, and it went on so long that it just sent me ballistic. And I felt like, I can wait no longer. It tipped me over the edge. And by the time I'd composed the letter, it was Christmas Eve.
You sent off similar letters to the other people you ghost wrote for, including Pat Robertson, Billy Graham. None of these people knew you were gay when you were writing for them, but you knew it. How did you manage to write for people who had been clearly anti-gay in their rhetoric and stay in the closet?
See, during most of that time, I didn't think it was right to be gay either. I was taking electric shock treatments and exorcism and reparative therapy and doing all this ex-gay stuff, trying desperately to get my own act together while writing for them. So it wasn't so much as two-faced as it sounds. I kind of believed, first of all, I believed in what they were saying about Jesus, but secondly, I was confused enough about homosexuality that it never once crossed my mind that this was an integrity issue for me.
Now, did the people from the religious right who you were ghostwriting for know even that you were divorced? Or maybe you weren't officially divorced yet, but that you were separated from your wife?
No, in fact, Lila, because I was a ghost and because I wasn't signing any of their material, see, there's not even any pictures of me with them because I was trying to protect them in case I was discovered. I didn't want anything to hurt their ministries. That's the kind of regard I had for them. So they didn't know about my divorce either. Lila simply said to them, look, you're a ghost. What do we owe them?
Well, you thought they could be blackmailed if they...
Oh, yeah, I thought that they could be ridiculed and all that. No, I did not want to bring public shame to them. But they have done such dangerous and demeaning things to lesbians and gays that I felt like someone had to say it. And so I'm saying it now, probably without much effect.
Did homosexuality come up a lot in conversations you had with the people you ghost wrote for? Did you not really get to talking about much?
No, they occasionally made a queer joke. Ollie North was especially good at pretending to be queer. He could sound like a queer better than any queer I have ever met.
Wait, what do you mean?
Oh, you know, I can't do it. And Gary always says, don't do it publicly. You know how the caricature gay talk with a lisp and all of that. He would call me. Ollie would call me from a limousine and pretend to be a gay and make a big joke, never knowing that I was gay. And it wasn't cruel. It was funny. Like when he did it at the banquet the other day and said, the only way to get in the White House now is to have a lisp. He doesn't mean to be as cruel as he is, but now I see them all in different light. I really liked them in those days, so I forgave them way too much.
Mm-hmm. The letter that was the turning point for you in 1991, where you felt like if this is what the Falwell organization is putting out, mm-hmm. you just couldn't take it anymore. You had to start to take action. Do you remember what was said in that?
I certainly do. Yeah. I will never forget it. He was in Los Angeles, and a gay demonstration was in the hotel, outside the hotel where he was staying, coincidentally, protesting the Briggs Amendment or one of those anti-gay initiatives. And when they found out the Falwell was in the hotel, they began to chant about Falwell. And Falwell got the impression that his life was endangered and that they were there to kill him. And so he claimed to his mailing list, which is in the millions, that gays had gathered around his hotel to kill him, and that his life is being threatened, and if they send money, they will keep the dream alive. Well, the Los Angeles Times heard about the letter, came out, and did a front-page story with all eyewitness police and observers who said he was never in danger, and that he had never been come close to having anyone even malicious intent. They were simply demonstrators exercising their right to protest. And when I found out that he had not only said these nasty things, but said that we're out to kill him, and that there was this conspiracy to end his ministry, and that he was using that to raise money, I thought it's one thing to caricature us, but then to make us dangerous to the country.
Do you think the, quote, homosexual threat is particularly effective to organize or fundraise around?
It must be, or they wouldn't use it. They're using it over and over. We have 73 or so monitors at the Cathedral of Hope in Dallas, where I'm the dean, just monitoring 73 different religious individuals from the religious right, and they are all using it. The homosexual threat has become a major fundraising tool when there is, in fact, no threat at all. We are the ones whose civil rights are being threatened on a daily basis in states and counties and townships across this great country.
How did you become the ghostwriter for so many of the leaders of the religious right?
There's an easy answer. Billy Graham had heard that I was a good ghost and asked me to ghost for him. And once you've written for Billy Graham, everybody else wants you.
Run through the list of people who you've done.
Oh, my. Is this my shame? Mea culpa list?
That's not why I'm asking. I want our listeners to know the list.
Yeah, I've worked for so many of them, starting with Francis Schaeffer way back when I did his How Should We Then Live, a television series. You don't know him, but he was an American guru who, for the fundamentalist world, it led to this whole thing about co-belligerency and using people to make our point.
What does co-belligerent mean?
These are people who are co-belligerents because they have mutual enemies in common. At first it was the communists, then it was abortion and homosexuality. You know, the first political action committee that Hitler and Goebbels did was the committee to end homosexuality and abortion. It's an old trick. Jerry found it worked. He built a moral majority on that co-belligerency idea. The list goes on with Jim Kennedy in Coral Ridge, Florida. He's putting out some of the most hateful stuff I've ever seen against gays, and I've done two films for him and know him intimately. After that, of course, Pat Robertson, writing his campaign book and other things. W. Criswell, the pastor of the Big First Baptist Church in Dallas. I wrote his autobiography, Standing on the Promises, the man who's probably the founder of modern fundamentalism. And then people like Ollie North and other political figures. But basically, it's across the road from Billy Graham to the most extreme of them.
And what'd you do for Ollie North?
Oh, Jim and Tammy Baker. I wrote their biography. Ollie wanted me because Jerry Falwell and Ollie are so close. You know, people who vote for Ollie North in Virginia are voting for Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. He is simply an extension of their mentality, and they're helping him make the money. That's why Ollie North is sending out fundraising letters bashing gays to make money for his candidacy.
So what did you write for him?
Jerry Falwell told Oliver North that I was a great ghostwriter. Oliver North was looking for a ghostwriter for his biography. he called me. We struck it off. I sat in the front row of that incredible trial with his wife and family. I watched what that man went through. And all the time he was negotiating with his publisher, who would be the ghost, and they didn't want me in the long haul. They said no. So during that time, I learned to know Ollie, wrote his speeches, some of his speeches, not all that many, actually. But I was going to write his biography, and then I came out, and everything went crashing down.
My guest is Mel White. He's written a new memoir called Stranger at the Gate, To Be Gay and Christian in America. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mel White. Let's talk a little bit about when you were young. And I think you knew pretty young that what you were feeling had more to do with other boys than other girls.
Yeah.
You grew up in an evangelical family. Your grandmother even ran tent revival. So tell us a little bit about what it was like to suspect that you were gay in an environment where that this was going to be just massively disapproved of.
Ambivalence. It's so incredible to be a part of a warm and loving and progressive and intelligent family and still be a victim of that childhood. I mean, if I said bad things about my parents, they would be untrue. But in fact, the other side of me was dying, because at 12, I realized I liked boys instead of girls. At 13, that didn't change, though I prayed and fasted and prayed and fasted in silence. At 14 and 15 and 16, it went on. By the time I was in high school and wanting to kiss the football player instead of the princess of the game, I was convulsed with guilt and convulsed with fear. I hadn't acted on my sexuality at all, but I was just terrified by it. So when I look back at my childhood, I say, I honor my parents for being good parents, but I wish with all my heart that someone had been able to say to me, gay is good.
You were married for about 25 years, and you say that you really loved your wife, but you write on your wedding night, you learned, quote, that with a lot of love and huge doses of imagination, sex can be beautiful and exciting, even between a hopelessly heterosexual woman and a confused and embarrassed gay man. So you were able to sustain a close relationship, even though you knew you were gay.
Yeah, and because I told Lila during the first year all about it, and she said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to get over it. If this is retarded adolescence, I want to end it. If this is sin, I want to be forgiven. If this is some kind of bizarre psychological, pathological thing, I want to be healed. So we worked for 25 years to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about what you tried to do to get over your homosexuality. First, you tried praying to God to be healed. When did you decide that that wasn't being very effective?
I love the way you say not being effective. It wasn't very effective from the beginning. It never influenced anything. And I just wish now God could have gotten through all my defenses and said, Mel, it's the wrong prayer. Quit praying it. In fact, I've given you this as a gift. But it was not until 10 years ago that I finally quit praying that prayer and began to thank God for my sexuality. I did it all. I prayed up until, at least 10 years ago.
Now, you tried aversion therapy?
Yeah. Aversion therapy is when you eat something terrible tasting when you're stimulated by the wrong sex. It's just like electric shock. They brought pictures of men and pictures of beautiful women. And when I had to shock myself, electric shock is a matter of, and I wanted so badly to get over it that I would shock myself fiercely. When they'd even show me pictures of me that were attractive to me, and I had to shock myself. Same way with eating a candy bar that was ugly tasting whenever I thought of a man, so that I would try to think about a woman.
Now, you tried exorcism. What led to the exorcism, and what was it like?
Well, we who are, biblically based know that Jesus did something for those who are filled with evil spirits. And in that culture, we believe that there is evil in this world and that some of us need to be exorcised from that. My dad said to a broadcast in a local area just the other day that he thinks I'm devil-possessed still. Even though he loves me and cares about me and has come to be with us on the ranch, he's still confused by it. So we prayed, first of all, with Protestant exorcists. I would kneel down at an altar, and they would lay their hands on me, and they would anoint my head with oil, and they would pray that this evil spirit of homosexuality would come out of me. And I would pray, and I would cry, and I would believe with all my heart. And I'd get up and not feel any different.
After, you know, trying prayer and aversion therapy, shock therapy, exorcism, at what point did you decide, well, maybe I should try homosexuality?
First came the desire to die, because when nothing works and you feel like you're not going to be redeemed and that God is, for, you know, God has given up on you. See, that's the whole religious right line, that being a homosexual is a sign that God has given up on you.
Uh-huh.
And so when you really believe the religious right, that God has given up on you, that there's no way back, that you've tried everything, then all you want to do is die. And when I tried to kill myself several times, once, for example, I ripped a hanger apart and started ripping at my wrists with this curled end of the hanger until flesh was gathering and my wife was crying and I was crying. Once you show enough signs that you're really serious about dying, then you have to make a choice for life, even if it's the wrong choice. And so Lila came to me and said, Mel, you are sincerely, you've tried everything. Don't, we want you to live, even if I lose you, even if we separate and divorce. And divorce really was more her gift to me, because I couldn't do it. I loved her so much, and I love my family so much, that the idea of leaving them to me was worse than any idea. And yet, staying in a heterosexual marriage and being a gay man was getting to be impossible. I longed for appropriate affiliation, for appropriate intimacy, for appropriate sex acts, and not having to use all these fantasies to get through it after 24 years. And she said to me, Mel, go.
Connect that for me to the phase of your life where you were ghostwriting for Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Jim and Tammy Baker. Where were you in your development of understanding who you were, and where were you in the development of aversion therapy and all that?
I don't remember the year, but the first ghostwriting I did, main line ghostwriting, was for Billy Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just before that time that a psychologist who had brains and heart from Fuller Seminary, Dr. Phyllis Hart, said to me, Mel, you're not sick. You're a gay man. You just need to fall in love with another gay man and get it over with. And I left there thinking, she's a wicked woman. Because she's telling me this terrible thing. And then all of a sudden I heard her words. You're a gay man. You're not sick. Fall in love with another gay man and get it over with. And I fell in love. Infatuation at 42 is not a pleasant sight. I fell in love with a young lawyer in Chicago. And at the moment, after a year of kind of courtship, Lila and he and I together and apart trying to work all this out and how you do it, Billy Graham called out of nowhere. Just the day I was going to fly to be with Thomas and end my one life and begin another, Billy Graham, my childhood hero, called and said, can you come to Acapulco today and help me with a book? And I flew, I called Thomas and I said, this is an act of God. And I broke it off with this guy that I love so much. Flew to Acapulco. Billy Graham said, I can't see you for a few days. Just go to the hotel and rest. I'll see you on Monday. I flew to Chicago. Then Thomas wouldn't see me. So I flew back to Acapulco just in time to write this book. I was going crazy. And during this time, falling in love with Thomas, trying to come to terms with my sexuality, I started saying, I've got to pull the plug. This is crazy. I won't make it. So it was at the beginning of the ghostwriting that I first of all wanted to die and then began the climb back. So simultaneously as I'm writing for these guys, I was making the climb to health and to wholeness.
Do you support any of the agenda of the religious leaders that you ghost wrote 4 years ago?
I support so many of the things that Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson believe in terms of prayer and the importance of Scripture and the importance of the community of faith and the importance of Christ as Lord and Savior and the God who's a loving Creator. I believe those things. But when people ask me today if you're a Christian, I say, who's a Christian to you? And they say Billy Graham or Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell. And I say, then I'm not a Christian. I'm a follower of Jesus. The irony is I'm so orthodox. It's boring. But I really believe so many of the things they say, and yet I want to distance myself now.
When you wrote your coming out letters to the people you'd ghost wrote for, Falwell, Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, did you think of yourself as being some kind of example that would disprove their stereotypes or something? Did you hope that you would be evidence that they were wrong?
Well, the first thing I have to say to you is that I came out to them in the spirit of Matthew 18:15, which says, Jesus said, if your brother has aught against you, you go to him in private. You don't make this a public affair. So I went to them hoping that they would talk to me about the issues and all the new information we have about sexual orientation and its source, to talk about the scriptures and their new understanding we have about them. I waited for a year. I sent them facts and letters and everything that they wouldn't. So I really came out to them hoping that they would talk to me. And in process, I could introduce them to information and to friends and to authority figures who really could enlighten their misunderstanding about gays. The more then I realized they're not going to talk to me, so I'm going to have to take this issue public. About that time, the studies, CNN did a study with a newspaper, I can't remember which it was, and they found that half the people in America roughly believed in gay rights and the other half didn't. And the factor was that the people who believed in gay rights were people who knew a lesbian or gay personally, or thought they did. And so for me to come out then was the greatest act of justice I could perform. By knowing me, they could at least say, we know one person who is not the stereotype that we've created.
Do you hope you will hear from them in the future?
Oh, man, I hope every day that they will call me up someday and say, Mel, come talk to us. But right now, you see, they've backed into such a corner. They can't. They have too much at stake, both in terms of the money they make and the volunteers they mobilize around this issue. This whole idea of co-belligerence. There could be no Catholics working with Jerry Falwell if it didn't have abortion and homosexuality as their primary issues. Cardinal O'Connor would not speak to Pat Robertson without the issue of homosexuality and these trumped-up things about the American family. So they're too committed. And that's what I'm afraid of, that lesbian and gay people are going to be sacrificed for the greater good. Look what happened to the military ban. Poor President Clinton walked into a hornet's nest. He had no idea at how strong the religious right is. The Christian Coalition has now over 900,000 members working in 50,000 American precincts, and their primary goal is to stop gay and lesbian rights.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Mel White is the author of the memoir Stranger at the Gate, To Be Gay and Christian in America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.